Hello, cinephiles. We are getting closer and closer to what some people believe is the most romantic day of the year, Valentine's Day. My name is Steve Morris. I am a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Roque. I'm a writer, producer, host, and voiceover artist here in San Diego, California.
And we are celebrating romance cinephiles style by going through what we think are some of our most romantic movies. And we have arrived at we were just in a movie from the 90s that explored a gay couple and that involved someone dressing up as a different gender in order to fool someone. And now we have gone back to the classic film of that genre where we have Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon having to pass themselves off as female band members in Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot.
Well, no one's perfect. This is one of those films that I remember watching with my parents and just falling in love with this movie because of the great performances from Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon and the situational comedy within it and the confident direction of Billy Wilder and, of course, Marilyn Monroe, and seeing the different approaches to this kind of situation that they're in. Not only fish out of water, not only people who've made mistakes and caused themselves to get into they caused themselves to have enemies with people who are really powerful, but also how they navigate all of this, how they step into being the world of a woman, how it displays being a woman in the world at that time. I thought the film was groundbreaking and really illuminating for what it was and when it came out.
Well, and I think what's so interesting is love isn't one thing. So far we've had the intense, even combative, sometimes violent love of Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah.
We've had the profound and moving and restrained, unrequited love of Remains of the Day. We've had the impossible love because of what society says in Brief Encounter. We've had love that's beautiful and mature and loving that society disapproves of. And now we have two love stories that are silly and ridiculous and comedic and hilarious and sexy and really, really, really fun. And that's a completely different way to look at a couple of love stories.
Agreed. Subtly brilliant from everyone involved in the film. You know, you've got the Tony Curtis, Marilyn Monroe romance, and you're seeing how that progresses. And because he's putting on a couple of faces. Not only is he pretending to be a woman, he's also pretending to be a rich aristocrat. So all these different approaches to that romance and how he can finally strip all that down and be accepted for who he is. And then looking at the end where Jack Lemmon rips off all his trappings and his masks here as a woman to reveal himself to be a man and have Joe E. Brown say that famous line that he says without missing a beat, because for him, it doesn't matter this is such a subversive moment that people don't seem to give enough credit to, but it's to him, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman. The fact that he feels this way for you is all that matters, and that's love, you know?
And if you're one of those people out there who goes, well, I'm not really that into black and white films, or, you know, older films are kind of boring, I only like new films, you guys got to check out Some Like It Hot, because this movie is damn funny. It is a well-made movie. And I think that's exactly what we're about to do as we jump into the world of Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot.
Lights, I can't see what I'm doing.
No lights. We don't want them to know we're having a party.
But I may spill some.
So spill it. Spills, thrills, laughs, and games. This may even turn out to be a surprise party.
What's a surprise?
Uh-oh. Not yet.
When?
Better have a drink first.
That'll put air on your chest.
No fair guessing.
Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a great film, we explore its themes, the history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on us today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
My name is John Roque. I'm a voiceover artist, host of numerous shows here in L.A., frequent guest on shows here in L.A., and occasionally an actor.
And a just well-known man about town.
Yeah, the outlaw and all things, yes.
I think that should be the new slogan, the outlaw and all things, yes.
Yes, it should be right there on a t-shirt.
And today, I'm really excited to do a movie that I think you are really excited to do.
Absolutely. When you mentioned this a couple of weeks ago or a few weeks ago, I was like, yeah, this would be a great one to do, because a lot of people kind of quietly love this film. It's not one of the ones that people like throw up in the air all the time when they talk about their favorite comedies, but it's certainly one that people speak of with reverence, you know? And so it's interesting. It almost transcends a comedy genre to become a classic film.
Absolutely.
So I'm excited to talk about it.
Well, and it is listed, I think, as AFI's number one comedy of all time.
Not a surprise.
Yeah, and of course, we're talking about Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, 1959, starring Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis, and of course, Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah, the lovely, beautiful Marilyn Monroe.
Very, very beautiful.
And Joey Brown and George Raft. So many amazing character actors that litter this throughout this film that's fantastic.
Absolutely. And let's just jump right into it.
Yeah, sure.
And it's funny, like in this movie, we kind of have, you know, sometimes we give some little biographical material about various people involved. And usually I try to pick the most important person.
Yeah.
And there are four big people in this movie.
Yeah.
And I want to start with Billy Wilder.
Sure.
Who is was born in Austria. He's Jewish. He became a journalist, escaped just as the Nazis were taking over to Paris. Essentially, his whole family was killed in the Holocaust. Became a filmmaker in Paris and then immediately came to Hollywood, became a naturalized citizen. And he is, in addition to being one of the great directors of all time, he is one of the great screenwriters of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah, his first film he wrote in Hollywood is Ninotchka.
Wow.
Directed by Ernst Lubitsch.
Yeah.
Yeah, Garbo. And then just the list goes on and on. And what's interesting about him, by the way, is that he goes from these really bright, sparkling comedies like Some Like It Hot to just being the noir guy as well and being able to handle some drama. So he does, you know, he does Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, The Lost Weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, that Lost Weekend is a heavy.
I recently saw that for the first time 2 months ago. Ray Milland. Lost Weekend. And Ray Milland had no one had wanted him for the role. And so he really attacked, because he was a B-movie actor, essentially, and he tackled it with gusto. But the script is so fantastic. What it explores for that time is amazing. And that's what's so great about Billy Wilder, is his ability to excel at whatever genre he decides to tackle. He really is just an anomaly, a unicorn, you might say, in the film world, because not a lot of directors and writers can do that so successfully.
Absolutely. And he is very much a writing craft guy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't interested in Orson Welles' crazy camera work, or you know, he wasn't into big amazing concepts. He didn't want to do big budgets. He wanted to do perfectly well-crafted, well-written movies. And you see, there's the list just goes on and on. There's Stalag 17, there's The 7-Year Itch, which is the first movie he does with Marilyn.
Right.
You know, he does The Apartment, has this long relationship with Jack Lemmon. I mean, the he's one of our great directors, and one where, for those of you who want to be screenwriters, go back and you know, go back and go through them. One of them that I love, by the way, is the Danny Kaye movie, A Song Is Born.
Oh, okay.
Which I just, it's one of my guilty pleasure musicals. It's so much fun.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
Oh, it's really good.
Yeah, I love Danny Kaye.
It's a remake of, he did I think it's called Ball of Fire.
Okay.
Which is about people writing an encyclopedia, and then there's the story with mobsters, not unlike Some Like It Hot.
Right.
And this one is, they're doing a musical encyclopedia, and there's a singer for some band, and Danny Kaye is an intellectual who falls in love with the mafia girlfriend singer. And it's really, I mean, I could watch Danny Kaye all the time.
Yeah.
I just love Danny Kaye.
Yeah. He's so funny.
One, by the way, I want to do for Cinephiles. Yeah. Is The Court Jester.
Yes, The Court Jester.
We absolutely have to do it sometime.
Such a good film. Okay. Yes, absolutely.
But we digress.
Yes.
and the other person I just want to, we have to talk about, and I think she towers over the whole film, is Marilyn Monroe.
Well, and this is what's amazing watching it this time. I don't know why I didn't notice it in any of my previous viewings of this movie. She gets top billing.
Oh, yeah.
She's first.
She's the biggest star.
That's
There's
amazing
no question about
me.
It.
Yeah, it's amazing to me.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about her history. The first thing I wanted to say about her is that we talked about this idea of charisma, and in talking about other actors, we talked about with Jack Nicholson, we talked about Charlie Chaplin, we talked about it with various people. Marilyn Monroe's another one of those people who just sparkles on the screen.
Yeah, she
you
really
can't. Take her eyes off her.
You can't quantify this woman. This is legitimately, there are just some people that you see on screen or you experience their energy or their essence, and you just can't quantify them. I think young Brando, I think Marilyn, I think James Dean.
Yep.
These are people that when you see them, you're just like, this is a whole nother level of human that I can only admire and be in awe of, but in no way can I...
Well, and you can't
understand.
You can't. You're right. You can't quantify it.
Yeah.
You don't understand. Like, I know that something is affecting me.
Yes.
But I don't understand what it is.
Right.
Well, and the thing about her, I was thinking about this, is that she falls into a very, very small category, which is like, if you go, here's my example of it. If you go up to Hollywood Boulevard and you go in front of the Chinese theater, you're going to see a whole bunch of characters. You're going to see Superman. You're going to see Batman, Spider-Man. You're going to see some Transformers. You're going to see Captain Jack Sparrow.
Yeah.
And there's only three people you will see that are themselves, which is Charlie Chaplin, Elvis, and Marilyn Monroe. And in each of those cases, those people created a persona which is not them, but we perceive as them.
Yeah.
Like, you can picture Johnny Depp and not picture Captain Jack Sparrow.
Right.
But it's very hard to picture Charlie Chaplin and not picture the Little Tramp.
Yeah.
Or Elvis and not see him all Elvis-y.
Yeah, and this is why Universal Studios, where I work, has a Marilyn. They have Marilyns that come and walk around the park, Chaplins that walk around the park. It's for that reason. There is just, they are just incredible persons, incredible energy, incredible icons to be around, and they, so much so. But even more than Charlie Chaplin, because Charlie Chaplin isn't Charlie Chaplin, he's the Tramp.
He's the Tramp.
Marilyn is playing Marilyn.
That is Marilyn. And
from
of course,
7 Year Itch,
that's not Marilyn.
Right.
Like she's born Norma Jean.
Yeah.
What's her last name?
I forget what it is.
Call her Norma Jean.
Norma Jean.
So she's born Norma Jean. She has a really, really tough childhood.
Yes.
She had multiple foster homes. Mm-hmm. She has a mom who was a paranoid schizophrenic.
Right.
Spent most of her time institutionalized. She was sexually abused. Married young,
yeah.
Yeah, like real... This is really tough.
Yeah.
Began as a pinup girl, became a studio player for Fox, and always really struggling in the late 40s, early 50s, disrespected. And, you know, we have to say that Marilyn was sexually active with many, many powerful men that she interacted with as she kind of moved her way up in her career.
Right.
And we could say different things about this. And this is part of the mystery, I think, of Marilyn, which is one thing we could say is, oh, these are powerful men taking advantage of this woman in need, this young woman coming to Hollywood. We could say there's some that might say, oh, this is a woman who is, you know, a climber using her sexuality to get ahead. We could say that this is a woman who didn't care about the sexual mores at her time, was perfectly comfortable with her own sexuality. Or we could say that this is a woman who was deeply troubled and was vulnerable and was desperately looking for love in ways that really got her hurt and injured.
Yeah, but I think another way is this determination through it all that to achieve something. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And I think that's, to me, whatever you want to characterize it, and that's your own personal thing for anybody listening or us talking about it, I think the thing that always sticks out for me is this is a woman that at every turn could have been dismissed, pushed aside, thrown away, and kept going forward. And in fact, her list of husbands is a who's who of intelligent people and people of accomplishment, you know? And so other than the first husband, obviously, but like her determination, she, you know, she's a redhead or she's a brown haired or she's a brunette or something. She converts herself into this thing. She puts on the weight. She leans into it, but, and she finds a strength. She negotiates the contracts with it to get herself.
Absolutely.
So she's a young girl who, it's almost like King Arthur, right? What we see in Excalibur, young, bright eyed, bushy tailed, walking into the world, what am I, this? And then by the end, this grizzled veteran. She is, by the end, a veteran of the wars, but the scars were too deep.
Very deep.
And that's the unfortunate tragedy of her, because she could have been, I think in our time, an incredible icon with incredible strength and power and determination, would have found solace in other women who would bolster that. But at this time in our country's history, it wasn't that kind of thing. It was kind of frowned upon because she got a lot of shit from other actresses who were jealous of her sex appeal, thinking it wasn't her talent, that it was her sex appeal. But she transcends that shit. And that's what's so fascinating about her. And that's why I respect her very much.
Well, and the thing I would say is that she's unknowable.
Yeah.
Like, is like who she was. I think of all those different motivations that I listed, I think it's probably all of them in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get to really know. And the one thing we do know is that persona is, and what all these other actresses complain about her sex appeal, that was consciously built.
Yeah, of course it was.
They were refining the hair, they were refining the makeup, refining the behavior. All of that stuff was a character that she put on. And what that relationship between that character and the real Marilyn is, we're not going to know.
Yeah.
You know, maybe Joe DiMaggio and Arthur Miller know.
Yeah.
You know, who are two of her most famous husbands.
Right.
But we don't really get to know.
Well, Rita Hayworth said this too one time. She said, you know, people go to sleep with Gilda, but they wake up with me.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that's like the truth, right? We create this, we believe what we see on the screen to be real. Even in a very small context, as the outlaw, people think, I'm this way in real life. And it's like, no one would be around me if I was this way in real life. Like, and but people buy into this whole idea of it because sometimes they just get lost in the you do a character so well, they think there's no way you're not that person.
Well, you know, and what I'm saying? And it's like, what's hard is there is some of the outlaws in you.
Sure.
There's
of course.
Truth there.
I can't bring that out if it wasn't there, right?
Yeah, it's funny. This is a digression, but I listen to Fresh Air all the time with Terry Gross. She's a great interviewer. But when she interviews artists, she particularly writers, she always asks, how is this like your life?
Yeah.
That's always the question. And as if there's a one-to-one relationship between the things the artists experience and the things that they do. And the connection is much more ephemeral. It's like something might be inspired by a thing in your life, but that doesn't mean that that's what happened.
Right.
There's truth there, but it isn't the whole truth. Mm-hmm. And this is really, and this is certainly true of Marilyn Monroe, which is this is coming from her.
Yeah.
But how that relates to the real her, we don't get to know.
Right, and it's a fuzzy line, Steve, between how much of this
was almost the fuzzy end of the lollipop.
Yeah, oh, nice reference to the line in the movie. But like, this is an interesting situation because how fuzzy is the line between her being manipulated to be and created, right? And how much of this that she owns later on in life as she becomes a woman? How much of this does she own and realize that this is the exchange for her power? You know, and so who knows?
And well, it's fuzzy. And it's
that's why I hesitate to call her a victim. I hesitate to call her a victim.
Oh, I I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, and she's certainly, I would say, a victim of her own success.
Sure. Well, you know what I mean? In that way, yes. Yeah. And of course, victim of sexual harassment, victim of sexual abuse. Absolutely. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying, I think by calling her a victim overall of her life, that you remove her determination, her ability, her achievements, her successes,
right,
in my opinion.
I agree. Yeah. Totally agree. All right, let's get into the movie. Enough talk about this. We start in a hearse.
Yes.
And a cop car comes up behind it. They pull machine guns out of the roof of the hearse, and we're in the middle of a pretty good car chase.
Right? It's like a beginning of a Bond movie. All of a sudden, it's a car chase.
And there's this one spin out of the cop car. That is a really good stunt.
Yeah.
That is a great stunt.
Yep.
And then we see in the hearse that they open up the coffin and booze is pouring out of it because, of course, it's Chicago. It's 1929, and it's the middle of Prohibition, and these are bootleggers.
Yeah.
And one thing that we have to say about this movie is this movie is like might be the first like meta movie because not only is it referencing a whole bunch of kinds of gangster movies from the 30s, but it actually is bringing the stars of those movies like George Raft into this movie or Edward G. Robinson Jr., who's flipping a coin.
Right.
The guy picks up a grapefruit at one point and is going to smash someone's face with it.
Yeah, the Public Enemies.
We got Pat O'Brien, who's been playing cops and guys like this in these kinds of movies.
And played Newt Rockney.
Yeah.
In the Ronald Reagan movie.
Wait, but is Newt Rockney's not the coach, is he?
Yeah, Newt Rockney's the coach, yeah.
All right, sorry. Dumb.
Sports, Steve.
I'm familiar. I've heard of them. Okay. So we get to this funeral home.
Yeah.
And there's Pat O'Brien and a bunch of cops, and Pat O'Brien goes into the funeral home. He knows the secret code word that he got from Charlie Toothpick.
Poor Charlie Toothpick.
We're all right in the middle of this gangster film.
Yeah, it's so great.
You know, it's kind of a prologue. And what's an interesting thing in comedy, in doing a comedy, one of the things you want to get to really fast is your first laugh.
Yeah.
Because the first laugh lets the audience know it's okay to laugh. This movie's not in a rush.
No.
We're really in a gangster movie for the first 7 or 8 minutes.
Right. But what helps us move into the comedy moments is Pat O'Brien's delivery of this character, right?
Yeah.
It is a little over the top. It's straightforward. It's all this kind of stuff and the way he delivers it. So already your sensibilities are leaning towards a comedic tone and before the first joke is made.
Right. Which we go into this great speakeasy that's behind like the organ or something in the funeral home.
Right.
Waiter comes up, and this is like the first sort of funny moment, I think, is, you know, he makes Pat O'Brien says, "Oh, I've been on the wagon or something," and the waiter goes, "Oh, no, we just serve coffee here." Coffee? Scotch coffee, vodka coffee, gin coffee, bourbon coffee. So he gets his little drink. in walks our big bad guy, Spats Columbo, played by the great George Raft.
Yeah.
Who is a veteran of gangster films.
And knew gangsters in real life. Like friends with Bugsy Siegel. Yeah, this guy, interesting history in Hollywood.
This guy is hooked up.
Yep.
And just as we're sort of setting that stuff up, we slowly pan over to the band.
Yeah.
At least these two guys in the band. Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis.
Say, Joe, tonight's the night, isn't it?
I'll say.
What? No, tonight's the night we get paid. That's good.
Why?
Oh, I reckon fiddling among my back teeth. I gotta see a dentist tomorrow.
Dennis, we've been out of work for 4 months. You want to blow your first week's pay on your teeth?
Well, it's just a filling. It'll never be gold.
It'll never be gold. How can you be so selfish?
We owe back rent. We're in for $89 to Moe's Delicatessen. Three Chinese lawyers are suing us because our check bounced at the laundry. We borrowed money from every girl in the line. You're right.
Well, of course I'm
First thing tomorrow, we'll pay everybody a little something on account, huh?
Oh, no, we don't.
We don't?
No, first thing tomorrow, we go out to the dog track and put the whole bundle on Greased Lightning.
Greased Lightning? You're going to bet my money on a dog?
He's a shoo-in. I got it from Max the Waiter. His brother-in-law is the electrician that wires the rabbit.
What are you giving me with a rabbit?
Look at the odds. He's 10-1 tomorrow. We'll pay everybody.
Suppose he loses.
What are you worried about? This job is going to last a long time.
Well, suppose it doesn't.
Jerry boy, why do you have to paint everything so black?
Oh.
Suppose you got hit by a truck. Suppose the stock market crashes. Suppose Mary Pickford divorces Douglas Fairbanks.
Suppose the Dodgers leave Brooklyn. Joe?
Suppose Lake Michigan overflows.
Well, don't look now, but the whole town is underwater.
One of the great things about film is how your stars are introduced. I think we've talked about this numerous times on the show, and to me, this is a great introduction.
I absolutely agree.
They don't have to say two words to each other. You see them playing. You get that they're friends. The fact that Jack Lemmon's body language is leaning into Tony Curtis, so you sense there's a connection between them without them even speaking a word. And it's just great. And then, boom, of course, we get to that point.
Right into that sparkling dialogue for Billy Wilder.
Yeah.
And you get their characters right away.
Exactly.
And I'm telling you, for screenwriters out there, if you want to learn to understand joke structure, watch this movie. It's set up joke. They're all just perfectly framed. And by the way, there are a lot of movies we've talked about where actors did a lot of improv on the set. Not this one.
No, I'm sure.
You don't mess with Billy Wilder.
Right.
And the other writer is I.L. Diamond, who's the co-writer. And he was on the set all the time. Billy Wilder felt his job was to film the script.
Right.
That was the job.
Wow.
Which is it's a different way of looking at it.
Yeah.
That's not what Francis Ford Coppola's doing on Apocalypse Now.
No.
He's exploring his artistic whatever.
Right, right.
Billy Wilder's like, we're filming this script. That is what we're doing. We spent a lot of time talking about Billy Wilder and Marilyn Monroe, so I only want to spend a little bit of time talking about Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon.
Yeah.
They are up-and-coming stars. Tony Curtis is the bigger star
at this point, right?
Yeah, because he's just done The Defiant Ones.
Right, with
Sidney Poitier, which is a really good movie.
A damn good movie.
Yeah, really good movie. He's born Bernie Schwartz in Brooklyn, a nice Jewish kid, served in the Navy during World War II. He was actually at the surrender of the Japanese.
Wow.
He was like standing right there on a naval vessel when that happened. And kind of struggled along as a star in the late 40s and sort of hit it in the 50s.
Yeah.
And Jack Lemmon is one of my favorite actors of all time. I think there are three people in history that I think are equally good at comedy and drama as Jack Lemmon.
Ooh.
And they are Jimmy Stewart.
Yes, I was going to say, you have to put that in there.
And Tom Hanks.
Wow.
Yeah. Is that when we first met Tom Hanks, he was a great comedian.
Yes, absolutely.
And then he went over and did some of the great dramas of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Lemmon is one of those guys.
Yeah.
Is that he is perfectly comfortable in either one.
Yeah.
He's a very well-trained actor, came out of the theater. And he's the smallest star. This is the movie. He had just done Mr. Roberts.
Right.
And that he got an Academy Award nomination, and then this is the movie that really solidifies him as a star.
Right, right. And then The Apartment really blows him up.
And it has this real relationship with Billy Wilder for 7 movies, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jack Lemmon, he's great.
Yeah, don't disagree with you at all.
Oh, I have one more thing to say about Jack Lemmon.
Sure.
Which is that he always believed in Billy being really supportive. He said, this is a quote from him, he said, "People who do well in the business have an obligation to send the elevator back down to people waiting on the ground floor."
That's a great
quote. And an example of this is he went to, and I'm not sure what the circumstances were, to see a high school play. And one of the kids in the play was really good. And he went backstage to tell that kid, hey, you should follow a career in acting. And that's Kevin Spacey.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And they are doing Glengarry Glen Ross years later.
Yeah, they do. And they do Iceman Cometh. Iceman they do Cometh, all right. this stuff. Yeah. Right. Yeah, it's like that's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, you got to love some Jack Lemmon.
Yep.
All right, so we got our two musicians. They're playing music, and they look over at Pat O'Brien, pulls out a badge. This might be some trouble.
And just casually pulls out a badge to stab, holes in his cigar to get better, to be able to suck it in better. And it's just like, well, he's just casually pulling out a badge. No big deal.
And they realize there's going to be a raid. They start to hightail it out of there just as the cops come and raid the speakeasy.
Yep.
We get outside. Spats Columbo is just has his, what he says are his Harvard lawyers.
Yeah.
Which are his big goons. He doesn't seem really scared of this raid.
Right.
And we're outside. They're rounding up all the drunks and everybody else. And who's sneaking down the fire escape but our main characters, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis.
Which will happen again later in the movie, which is an interesting bookend between the two situations.
They do a lot of sneaking out.
They really do.
Those situations.
Yeah.
And, we've kind of learned a little bit about their characters, that Tony Curtis is a little more aggressive, always want to make bets and gamble, and Jack Lemmon is more conservative. Right. And Tony Curtis always seems to get his way, though.
Yeah, he does. Well, that's why he's friends with Jack Lemmon. But Jack Lemmon, you see these, you may even have these friendships in your life, or you may see people who have these friendships in your life, and you're just like, you just kind of like go along, because there's something about the gambler personality that fills the holes into the person who's too conservative. It's just how it works. Like, the gambler usually gets his way.
Absolutely. Having been I'm much more the Jack Lemmon kind of guy. There have been lots of times where I've been somewhere and go, how the fuck did I end up here? Why am I doing this?
Yep.
But those some people just have that power.
Yeah.
And Tony Curtis certainly does. And we have a great button on the scene where he says,
I wonder how much Sam the bookie will give us for our overcoats.
Sam the bookie? Got nothing doing. You're not going to put my overcoat on a dog. Oh, look,
Jerry, I told you it's a sure thing.
We will freeze. It is below zero. We'll get pneumonia.
Look, stupid, he's 10-1. Tomorrow we'll have 20 overcoats. Joe.
Cut to the middle of winter. They're very cold.
Yes, and no overcoats.
No overcoats.
And true to form, Tony tries to convince him to trade in their instruments on another dog after they just lost all their money from the overcoats. Yeah,
it's great comic setup.
Yep.
And we're going to head up to the agency, and they go door to door trying to get some work.
As you did back in the old days.
Sure. Hey, look, if there was some building that you and I could go to go door to door, wouldn't you do
it?
We would totally do it. Just, hi, is anything for me? No. Anything for me? No. Unfortunately, one of the secretaries seems to know Tony Curtis.
Yeah.
He stood her up for a date. And yet he still is kind of charming to
her. Well, he's a charming guy.
He's very charming. That
some guys just get away with it in the bubble, man. Some guys just get away with it. I've seen it many times in my life.
Oh, it's true.
Yeah.
It's true, definitely.
Some guys just get away with it.
There are people that you and I could both name right now. But she's kind of a little irritated with him. She plays a little bit of a joke on him.
Right.
Well, it just so happens he is looking for a bass and a sax.
What's the job?
3 weeks in Florida.
Florida?
At the Seminole Ritz in Miami. Transportation and expenses all paid.
Isn't she a bit of terrific?
And of course, we go into the room where they're talking about this, and we find out that it's an all-girls band.
Right.
But they don't know this yet.
Not yet, no.
And they walk in, and they push hard to get this job.
Yeah.
No, no. And again, you see the classic I.L. Diamond, Billy Wilder setup and payoff.
Well, you need a bass and a sax, don't you? The instruments are right, but you're not. I want to speak to Mr. Morris.
Wait a minute, what's wrong with us?
You're in the wrong shape. Goodbye.
The wrong shape? What are you looking for, hunchbacks or something?
It's not the backs that worry me.
Well, what kind of a band is it anyway?
You got to be under 25.
We could pass for that.
You got to be blonde.
We could dye our hair.
And you got to be girls.
We couldn't. No, we couldn't.
But it's so interesting because then Jack Lemmon is the one that's like, oh, well, let's do it. We can do this. We can borrow the clothes. Remember, we did a hula skirts, all this kind of stuff. And we get a real glimpse into Jack's manic comedy instincts.
Yeah.
Right? Which is, and you said, this is the stage where he's just about to build himself up into a star. And he has really given a lot of moments to expand his comedy and play. It's not slapstick. It's just exciting comedy.
He's like enthusiastic.
Yes, yeah. It's enthusiastic comedy, which is when a good master actor does it, it's so much fun to watch.
Well, it never seems not real.
Yep.
It always seems like this person
yep.
who gets really excited and then really conservative and then really excited.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's so fun to watch.
Yeah.
But Tony's not having, we're not dressing up as women. That's a terrible, terrible idea. They get this other gig that sounds to pay like $6 to drive 100 miles, which even in 1929 seems like, or 28, seems like a bad deal.
Right.
They figure out they're going to borrow the secretary's car. They go to the garage and they walk right into the St. Valentine's Day massacre.
Yeah.
I mean, which is a real, I mean, it's an actual referencing event. A real event.
Yeah.
They, because Spatz Columbo shows up, wipes out Toothpick Charlie and all the other guys, and they witness the murder.
And I thought they were, and you know what's great is they witness it and they get caught witnessing it.
Oh,
which
yeah.
is a nice choice for the script to have them not be constantly running away, afraid that they're going to be caught in a way that's like, well, they might have known we were there. This is more action oriented. It's a great choice by the scriptwriter, by Billy Wilder and the scriptwriters, to do that.
Well, and it's a key plot point.
Yeah.
Because now they someone knows their faces.
Yes.
They run away, and Jack Lemmon had been the person who said, "Let's go dress up as girls." Before, Tony rejected it, and now we reverse it.
Yeah, well.
And Tony said, calls up and uses his voice.
Hello, Mr. Polyakov. I understand you're looking for a couple of girl musicians.
Such a great female voice.
Yeah,
I love it.
By the way. Not all him.
What?
So apparently he struggled to get that tone right.
Oh.
And what he says is they brought in a voice actor to, and he says that some of it is him and some of it is not him.
Wow.
And we don't really know how much is him and not him.
Is the voice actor a woman or a man?
No, a man.
Okay.
But I don't know the name of the voice actor. I probably should have found that out.
Okay.
Cut to legs.
Yeah.
It's great. They show up dressed in drag, walking down the, you know, in this train station.
Yeah.
I think they make pretty good-looking women.
good-looking women? Tony Curtis certainly makes a good-looking woman.
Jack Lemmon, maybe not so much.
And then that speaks to the prettiness of certain male actors. When they're actually pretty male actors, they can be women. They can pass as women, and it's believable. When you see something like Jack Lemmon or Dustin Hoffman in Tootsie, like you have to strain to accept it, but if it's done really well, you can accept it. And I think the hat on Jack Lemmon helps to accentuate all of that, which, of course, is a shout out to the costume designers and the people who coordinate this whole look of both Josephine and Daphne/Geraldine.
Well, and this is first of all, there's something I can't confirm, which is my gut is that this is why this movie's in black and white.
Oh,
because traditionally at this time, comedies were in color.
Right.
Black and white was for dramas.
Right.
But my guess is they went, you know, we got these guys in makeup. We can make them look a lot better in black and white. Color's not going to help them out. Right. And they actually did weeks of makeup tests to try to get to this point.
Right.
And when they finally got to this point, Tony and Jack said, let's test it out. And they went to the ladies' room on the studio lot and sat doing their makeup. And nobody noticed it. And they went, okay, we're good.
That they made great. It.
Ori Kelly's a very famous designer. Mm-hmm. And he's doing Marilyn's dresses.
Right.
And Tony and Jack went to Billy Wilder and said, listen, why don't you have them make our dresses too? So those dresses are also designed by this famous costume designer.
Right.
So we see them walking. Immediately we get some good comedy of Jack stumbling and how do they walk this way? And it's a completely different sex.
Yes. Yes. And throughout the movie, this is the first sample we get of numerous interactions between them about the struggles that women have.
Yeah.
In this world, in a man's world, and what they have to deal with day to day, which I don't know how much had been addressed in film up to this point in 1959.
I think in this sense, this is a very feminist movie.
Yes,
you know, because it really does show that stuff.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. I can't think of other movies that kind of went into those areas.
Yeah, I'm sure there are some Betty Davis films where she has these strong statements or strong points, but this is more about like what it's like to be a woman practically in the world. Do you know what I'm saying?
To do it, you take a man and put them in that position, and they go, oh shit, this seems really rough.
Yeah, exactly.
And as they're walking, who blows by them but Marilyn Monroe?
My word.
Yeah. I don't know how to put this. I'm just going to put it the straight up way.
Sure.
There's a lot of sex appeal here.
She's beautiful in ways that words don't even do justice. Like her sex appeal, her attraction, her energy, her essence is one of complete and utter just beauty. And like I said, I don't have the word for it. It's beyond beauty because you are aroused and you appreciate her as well for her face, her body, her voice. All of it is so incredibly gorgeous. But you also like want to sleep with her because she's so incredibly attractive. So it's like, yeah, I don't want to denigrate you and just want to sleep with you. I also appreciate like your entire energy, your entire essence as a woman, you know? So it's almost like this product to consume almost, you know what I'm saying? Because you see her and you're just like, I don't know what to do. I'm blown away by this.
Well,
like, I'm in awe. You know?
She is, I mean, I don't know what's happening. I'm a heterosexual man and and things are happening when I watch Marilyn, particularly this movie and that are, it's not that she's not unbelievably beautiful.
No.
She is.
Yes, she is.
But there's a lot of women that are unbelievably beautiful that do not have this effect. Marilyn somehow has to bottle something. Mm-hmm. There's a story, by the way, that a friend of mine told me that that Marilyn is walking down the street with a friend. It might be Paula Strasberg, who's Lee Strasberg's wife,
yeah,
who is her acting coach,
right?
And walking down with a friend in New York City, and nobody's paying any attention, and they're talking about like the Marilyn persona,
yeah.
And she and Marilyn basically says, "Do you want to see it?"
Wow.
And Paula says, "What are you talking about?" And Marilyn just is walking and changes her posture, her walk or something, and suddenly New York turns to her.
Wow.
And that there's some thing that she, and I don't know if this story is true, but I kind of believe it.
I would believe it 1,000%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something about her that just, you cannot take your eyes off her. Yeah,
absolutely.
And that also gets into some of the things we talk about that maybe are problematic about her, you know, in real life and who she is and all this other stuff.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
You know, John, I don't have to tell you that I had a pretty rough month last month. I had family commitments, work stuff was a bit overwhelming, and frankly, my battery felt drained. And one of the ways that I looked to charge up that battery came through therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. Steve, you know, you and I have both spoken about our therapy journeys here on the show. Certainly for me, one of the things that got me back in recharged, got me back connected to life, got me back ready to go and take control of my life was therapy. Once you go deep and find out what's going on, it's amazing how much more energetic, how much more you're willing to take part in your life. And therapy helps you do that for sure.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, I'd give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cinephiles.
So we meet Marilyn. She goes walking by. There's a blast of steam that comes off of the train, right, which is Billy Wilder's reference to the most famous moment of all time in his previous movie with her 7-year itch,
yes,
which is her over the subway grate.
Mm-hmm.
We meet the band leader. We introduce ourselves as Josephine and Daphne.
Yeah.
We get on the train and Jack Lemmon is very excited.
Yes, he is.
Literally a kid in the candy shop.
Literally a horn dog.
Yes.
Yeah.
He is thrilled to be here.
Right.
And I love the Tony Curtis settling him down, like, you're not here to sample the pastries. You're a girl. And Jack Lemmon's, I'm a girl.
And what's great is this is the difference. And this is a really small thing, but this is interesting. Someone who can get a woman anytime he wants. Tony Curtis versus a man who's like, oh, if I have a lot of options, I might have a chance.
Right.
Right. There's the Tony Curtis is like, just chill out, relax. And the other one's like bopping off, going crazy inside a cage. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so much fun to watch Jack Lemmon in this movie.
Agreed.
It's just a joy. We have a little more talk with Sugar, who is Marilyn Monroe's character's name. We see that she likes the bourbon.
Yes.
We go out to have our first rehearsal on the train, and you see Marilyn Monroe sing, and you know, it's the same thing. Marilyn Monroe is not the best singer in the world.
Right.
But there's something about her.
Yeah.
And both Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon really aware of that in this scene.
Yeah. And you see them, it builds from that first scene where they're talking with her up until this moment when they're watching her, where they're doing, where she's shaking and singing and doing whatever, and then the flask falls out.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Marilyn has told us, Sugar has told us that one more drinking incident, she's going to get kicked out of the band. Right. And who comes to her rescue?
Jack Lemmon. Yeah.
Oh, that's mine. Can I? Thanks for holding that for me.
Yeah.
It's a very smooth move.
But this is what's great about these Billy Wilder films. They are littered with these great actors who play these smaller parts and really flesh out those scenes. You know, and you have with the person who runs the band, right?
Sue.
Yeah. Sweet Sue. And then you have the Beanstalk. So Sweet Sue and Beanstalk are the back and forth. Just almost a comedy team themselves. Yep. You know what I'm saying? Almost Comedy in Green, you could maybe say, in the way that that's come out. And you see the way they play off each other. And it's great. And Sweet Sue does the brassy. She's almost the Eve Arden from Grease type of vibe. You know what I'm saying? And what's great also about these girls is the first thing they say once they lie about being in the conservatory when they're about to go onto the train, Geraldine and Daphne. Josephine, rather, and Daphne. The Sweet Sue says, well, we got to get the girls to watch their language. And that lets you know something. And this is the truth. Male or female, when you're a performer, it is not for the faint of heart. And there is a lot of rough conversations, rough behavior. performing is not some kind of beautiful thing where everyone's like taking in these, having these very intelligent, layered conversations.
Well, they might have lofty. Those too.
Yeah, sure, at some point. But there's the
but
base.
They're peppered in with a lot of other.
Of course, because you're around these people, you have to undress in front of these people all the time. Yeah. You have to have these kind of interactions. You have to be performing for other people who might be rude or might be appreciative of what you're doing. So it just naturally fosters that kind of mentality. So I love the fact that they didn't present these girls as like these little sweet, little dainty class manner girls. They are performers.
Well, it's, and it's such a great point you make, because Jack and Tony present themselves as, oh, we're from the conservatory, because their assumption is that behind the scenes, all these girls are going to be elegant and sophisticated, and that they realize really fast that is not the case, and that is awesome.
Yeah.
Which brings us, of course, to it's bedtime.
Yeah.
We're all getting into our compartments. Tony is reminding Jack, I'm a girl, you're a girl, you're a girl, you're a girl. And Jack is lying in bed, and who should pop up into his compartment but Sugar?
If there's ever anything I can do for you,
I can think of a million things. That's one of them.
Shh. Sweet Sue.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I better stay here till she goes back to sleep.
You stay here as long as you like.
I'm not crowding you, am I?
No, it's nice and cozy.
What a great back and forth between these two. In that moment, right? She climbs
in. The
scene
is magical.
Yeah, it really is. From him hitting his head when he wakes up to them having the conversation about, she's like, I anything you need. And he's like, I can think of 1,000 things.
Yeah.
Then she climbs in and he goes, that's one of them. And it's just brilliant.
It's so funny. Yeah. It's so sexy. Mm-hmm. It's so tight. The performances are so good.
Yeah.
It is an amazing little scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. And of course, what does Sugar want? She wants to have a drink.
Yep.
And fortunately, Jack Lemmon knows where he can find some drinks.
And find some whiskey. Yeah. And Jack is doing this because he says, I got a surprise for you, which is basically inferring he is going to reveal that he's a man to her.
Oh, yeah.
He cannot hold himself back. He's obviously has no control.
Well,
he's,
could you?
Yes, I know I couldn't. No, not with Marilyn Monroe.
If I'm lying in bed and Marilyn Monroe crawls into my bed and is snuggling with me.
Yeah, it's really tough.
That's really tough.
And what's great is they don't make any allusions to him like having a hard on or get like they don't play that note, which they don't have to.
Right.
Right. Her rubbing his feet. Him like, I'm a girl, I'm a girl, I'm a girl. Like, all of that is brilliant because you get what he's trying to do.
We get what's happening.
Exactly. You don't have to infer.
It's very clear.
I mean, you don't have to hit it on the head.
And of course, as soon as we get this booze, we realize somebody else has some vermouth.
Yeah.
We could be making Manhattans, and now we've got a party.
Now we've got a party.
Man, I like this
cheese
band.
Cheese and crackers. All. Yeah, this is a great band, right?
And apparently, Sweet Sue is a very sound sleeper.
Very sound. And 13 people climbed into that overhead. That's amazing.
And it's beautifully shot. Like, because that's not easy to get all those heads in just the right place. So you can see them with camera.
Yeah.
And now it's time for Tony Curtis to wake up.
Yeah.
And we go off to get ice, and we get Josephine, Tony Curtis's character, having a real nice heart-to-heart with Sugar.
What's the matter with you anyway?
I'm not very bright, I guess.
I wouldn't say that. Careless, maybe.
No, just dumb. If I had any brains, I wouldn't be on this crummy train with this crummy girl's band.
Well, why'd you take this job?
I used to sing with male bands, but I can't afford it anymore. Have you ever been with a male band?
Who? Me?
That's what I'm running away from. I worked with 6 different ones the last 2 years. Oh, brother.
Rob?
I'll say.
You can't trust those guys.
I can't trust myself. I have this thing about saxophone players. Especially tenor sax.
Really?
I don't know what it is, but they just curdle me. All they have to do is play 8 bars or Come to Me, My Melancholy Baby. And my spine turns to custard. I get goose pimply all over. And I come to them.
That's how?
Every time.
And that's when the idea comes to Tony about what he's going to do later on in the film. And that she's like, why she's going to Florida is to meet a rich guy who has a yacht, blah, blah, blah. She's basically laying the parameters of the guy, man, that she wants to be with, you know? And so you see that come up.
Absolutely. It's very, very clear. And Tony figures it out. And I think this is Marilyn at her best, by the way.
This scene.
I think in terms of acting, she's just great.
I agree. But I also think the scene with her and Lemon is fantastic in that.
Oh, yeah.
That's a scene that if you're an actress just known for your TNA or your looks, you will be transparent in a scene like that. Your limited abilities. Marilyn is a good actress. That comedic timing, the back and forth, the not betraying the different changing in moments between her and Jack as the conversation progresses is really amazing. And all the more so when we see her with Tony Curtis. Even more of her ability comes through when you see that scene. So I agree with you, man. Absolutely.
She's great. Jack Lemmon's now getting tickled.
Right.
And finally, in the midst of the tickling, to end this scene, pulls down on the emergency brake, which had been planted twice before.
Yes.
Because everything is well constructed in this movie. We end up in Florida.
Yes.
There we, and at this moment, we see the competition for Marilyn.
Yes.
This is where it really starts.
Yeah.
And Tony is moving in, and really, Jack does not have a lot of game. Even against Tony as a woman.
It's tough to beat Tony Curtis, man. But, but we're introduced also to Joey Brown. As they walk in with the instruments. Joey Brown is there to help Daphne.
I'm Osgood Fielding the third. Cinderella the second. If there's one thing I admire, it's a girl with a shapely ankle.
Me too. Bye-bye.
And we get another moment where what a woman has to deal with.
Absolutely.
The old guy is so fresh. He follows her into the elevator and attempts to try to make out with her or something. And the elevator, great little bit with the elevator stopping in the middle and going all the way back down. And then her slapping him and telling him, I don't know what kind of girl you think I am. And her storming. He goes, give me another. He says something like, she says, I'll walk. You know, like that. It's just a very, and this lets you know. You know, and it's played for comedy because he's turned and he's laughing about being slapped in the face.
He kind of likes it.
Yeah, but he likes it. Exactly.
I mean, so it is. It definitely shows that side of it.
Yeah.
And this is Joey Brown, who's a longtime character actor. Yeah. He's got one of the best names in any movie I can think of. Osgood Fielding the Third. That is a great, great name.
Names are important in comedy, man.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We get back up to the room. Jack Lemmon is pissed off because he's just felt what it was like to be a woman under these circumstances.
Yeah.
But Tony Curtis is playing his own game.
But isn't this where Tony gets kind of harassed by the bellhop as well?
The bellhop.
Yeah, so they both...
By the way, the bellhop is horrible.
Oh, what do you mean as a person?
Yes.
Yeah, but as an actor, the kid is fantastic.
He's great.
Yeah. But yeah, of course he's horrible. But they both experiencing their versions of harassment.
Absolutely. You know, no question about it.
Tony is like, the kid is like, he's too young to be hitting on her like that. And then when she pushes him away, or when Tony pushes him away, he says, I like him like that, big and brassy or big and bold.
Yeah.
And you're just like, holy shit.
Well, at one point, this bellhop says something like, I've got the key to your room.
Yeah.
It's like, holy shit. Yeah.
And then he says, get rid of the roommate.
Yeah.
It demands this punk kid. Of a woman.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Of a quote-unquote woman. And Jack's ready to go.
In his mind, it's a woman.
And Jack's ready to go. He's out. He's like, we got to Florida. Let's get the hell out. Tony wants to stay. And then in comes Sugar. Let's go to the beach. And Jack's all about going to the beach.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Tony doesn't really want to go with him. We'll find out why momentarily.
Yeah.
Because he swiped a suitcase, and he's trying on a new outfit.
Yes.
Has glasses.
Which just happens to fit.
Yeah, and those two guys do not look like they're the same size at all. And so we have Jack playing with Sugar in the beach. Again, Marilyn looks good in that bathing suit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this is an interesting, this is the beginning. This is Steve. This is an interesting conversation to have because this movie.
I hope it's an interesting conversation. Well, we've had people tuning in.
This movie, Jack is basically, and I know this term is like angers women now in 2017, but Jack is basically friend zoned from the beginning.
As a woman.
As a woman, yeah. She's friend-zoned as a woman. And even as a prospective suitor to us in the audience, knowing that this is a man, he's being friend-zoned. Tony negs her, which is what the term is, right? We've both read the game. That book,
I have not read the game.
You've read the game? One of the things they say about picking up women is sometimes you have to be like dismissive of them and not be like all about them and all over them from the beginning. Now, some women don't like that, obviously, and some women do like that. And so Marilyn responds to him like tripping. He physically assaults her, essentially, by tripping her to get her attention. And then he's aloof about her. And he's like, go away. You're blocking my yacht. You're blocking the flag. You do blah, blah, blah. He does all this stuff. And he keeps going back to his paper. But she keeps insisting on trying to talk to him because he's ignoring her. And these are tactics, right? And it's fascinating to watch the different tactics with Jack Lemmon wanting to do everything possible to make her happy. And Tony Curtis is doing everything possible to ignore her. And it works when you're an attractive guy.
That's what I was just going to say.
That's what I'm getting at. Because Tony's so attractive, it fucking works.
Because when an ugly guy says, stay out of my way, they go, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Why are you even talking to me?
But by the way, I'm so glad you did it because Tony Curtis does this Cary Grant impression.
Yeah. Very good.
That impression is so good and bad.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
It is so much Tony Curtis pretending to be Cary Grant.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me. Who runs up that flag? Your wife?
No, my flag's to it.
Who mixes the cocktails? Your wife?
No, my cocktails do it. Look, if you're interested in whether I am married or not...
Oh, I'm not interested at all.
Well, I'm not.
That's very interesting.
And right in this scene, they're immediately... What's interesting about it is Tony Curtis is obviously lying and manipulating her.
Yes.
She's lying too.
Yes, of course she is.
She's making up some story.
You're right. About how she's high and high,
high society, yeah, something.
That's what she wants to appeal to him. Yeah.
Syncopators. Does that mean you play that very fast music, jazz?
Yeah, real hot.
Oh, well, I guess some like it hot. I personally prefer classical music.
Oh, I do, too. As a matter of fact, I spent 3 years at the Sheboygan Conservatory of Music.
Good school. And your family doesn't object to your career?
They do, indeed. Daddy threatened to cut me off without a cent. But I don't care. It was such a bore, you know, coming out parties.
Inauguration balls.
Opening of the opera.
Riding to hound. You know, it's amazing we never ran into each other before. I'm sure I would have remembered anybody as attractive as you are.
And just as this conversation is finishing up, who walks up to Jack Lemmon? Not pleased. And of course, he can't out Tony without outing himself.
Nope.
It's a very complicated situation.
But a very great back and forth with the roommate being strangled by the brassiere.
Yes.
Just great stuff.
Jack and Sugar go back to the room.
Back to the room.
Yes. Yeah. And who do they find there but Josephine in the bath?
Yeah.
And she's just taking her bath. Sugar leaves, and I love... And Jack Lemmon is pissed off.
Yeah, he's mad.
I love the shot of Tony Curtis getting out of the bath.
Slowly.
wearing the sailor captain's outfit. It is hilarious.
Yeah, and then approaching him. And, of course, Jack Lemmon trying to fight him off in vain verbally, and then getting grabbed by Tony Curtis, which is great.
Yeah, and at this point, Jack Lemmon crumbles. And what's...
Yes.
Interesting about the movie is he stays crumbled.
Yeah.
For the whole movie.
Yeah.
He has completely abdicated any chance he has with Sugar. He's like, okay, I'm just going to do whatever you say from now on.
Which we've built that relationship up from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, now we never saw how he actually convinced him to hawk the overcoats.
Right.
But now we, you know, it's like, Jack Lemmon's always going to crumble.
Right. Right.
That's too bad. I love him.
Well, he's supposed to. It serves the movie.
Yeah.
And Tony's a better love story with the Marilyn Monroe character than Jack Lemmon would be.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
I think the Marilyn Monroe character in 10 years, Jack Lemmon is perfect for her. I think at this stage in her life, Tony Curtis is perfect for her.
Well, if we're in the 7-year itch, then the Jack Lemmon character is that.
Absolutely.
But that's not the movie we're
Great
in.
Great point.
We're in this movie.
Yep.
And just as we're having this conversation, we get a ship to shore call. It's our good friend, Osgood. And he wants to make a date with Jack Lemmon with Daphne.
Daphne.
And Tony insists that they make that date.
Mm-hmm.
Tony he's got a plan, man. He comes up with his plan really fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a dangerous person.
As soon as he says he has a yacht, he's like, oh, he's got this plan all set up.
It's all worked out.
Yep. Yep.
We go to the club. We have a big musical number. The costuming on Marilyn Monroe throughout this film, and it was very controversial at the time.
Oh, was it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Is so revealing.
Yeah.
It always is always giving you the impression that, is she naked? Like, what am I seeing?
Oh, good point.
The way things are lit, like the sheer skin colored, you know, where it's always very, very revealing, form-fitting. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it's pushing this image, this sexy image.
Yeah.
And we have this great setup where he takes the flowers that Osgood sent to Jack Lemmon and he gives them to Sugar.
Yeah.
He's manipulating this whole situation. He has Jack take Osgood, say, I don't want to go to the yacht, and that frees it up for Tony Curtis's character. Do we ever know what his name is? What his fake name is?
Well, he's Shell Jr.
Shell Jr., yeah. So Shell Jr.
For the Shell life.
To get on the boat and take Sugar off to the yacht.
Yeah.
the game that he plays on her in the yacht is crazy.
I mean, but once again, if you're a good-looking guy with money, you can get away with that, I think, a little bit by being like, all these doctors have tried to, you know, kind of figure out why I women just turn me cold. It's just a brilliant thing to play. And Marilyn, and some people might argue, oh, he's like manipulating her, blah, blah, blah. But there's still power in what Marilyn is doing. She's making the choice. She's playing along with the game. And I think there's a strength in that, in my opinion, as I watch the film. I don't think she's being like abused in any way, shape, or form. And she's also been lying to him too. So they're on an even playing field in a way.
I don't think it's even. I do okay. think she's definitely, if she hadn't been lying to him as well,
yeah.
then there's no question that this is abuse.
Right.
You know, he is completely manipulating, yes. you know, lying together for sex only with no, you know, he's pretending to be someone else in order right. to fuck this woman, you know. But because she's also lying to him, it mitigates that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But the advantage is, you're right. Actually, you're right, Steve, because the advantage is Tony knows she's lying to him.
Right.
So that's the good point. That's a good point. Yeah, I hadn't thought of
that. But it is a little complicated. First of all, I want to yeah. say about the scene, one of the great things is that you have two characters who are lying. They're lying stupidly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Each one knows that they are lying and therefore isn't like, neither of them are worrying about the stupid things the other one says
right.
because they don't care because they're both going after their goal.
Right.
It's a really, really funny scene.
Yes.
Like there's the whole thing. She points to like a marlin. What is that? Oh, that's a herring. How do they get them into the little cans? they shrink when you marinate them. It's just great joke yeah. setup, payoff.
Yeah.
Look at all that silverware.
Trophies. You know, skeet shooting, dog breeding, water polo.
Water polo? Isn't that terribly dangerous?
I'll say I had two ponies drowned under me.
Where's your heel collection? Mm.
Yes, of course. Now, where could they have put it? You see, on Thursdays, I'm sort of lost around here.
What's on Thursday?
It's the cruise night off.
You mean we're alone on the boat?
Completely.
You know, I've never been completely alone with a man before in the middle of the night, in the middle of the ocean.
Oh, it's perfectly safe. We're well anchored. Ships in ship-shape shape. And the Coast Guard promised to call me if there were any icebergs around.
It's not the icebergs, but there are certain men who would try to take advantage of a situation like this.
You're flattering me.
Of course, I'm sure you're a gentleman.
Oh, it's not that. It's just that I'm harmless.
Harmless? How?
Well, I don't know how to put it, but I've got this thing about girls.
What thing?
They just sort of leave me cold.
You mean like frigid?
Well, it's more like a mental block. When I'm with a girl, it does absolutely nothing to me.
Have you tried?
Have I? I'm trying all the time.
But the one thing I would say is that, and this is a weird thing, I'm watching it with my wife,
yeah.
and when we get to the points that you mentioned with the pinch and the walking in heels,
yeah.
Karen and I both go, yeah, this is really a feminist movie. Mm-hmm. And then she said something at the end, which I've thought about a lot, which she said, in some senses it is, but the character of Marilyn mm-hmm. is the male fantasy constructed sex pot.
Sure.
And that she is self-proclaimed, not bright,
mm-hmm.
obsessed and uncontrollably attracted to saxophone players.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have a lot of self-respect. She throws herself at men
mm-hmm.
and then isn't angry really, you know, it's like she's the ultimate sort of weak female sex fantasy. Is what she's presenting. And okay. that is sort of, I won't say, it's a great movie and it is what it is, but like it's sort of this character
yeah.
of the Marilyn character in a 2017 sort of more feminist world. It's like, oh, there's some trouble here.
Yeah. And this may be, and I get her point. And Karen is obviously, you know, it's a correct analysis for Karen, right? This is how she sees it. So I get that. And I can understand her point of view. I think for me, I never once think that she's not in control of what she's doing, that she's not, she doesn't know what she's doing, what she's trying to do, because she's also manipulating the situation to get yeah. with a guy who's rich,
right?
Right. Absolutely. Who's a billionaire. So to me, that undercuts a little bit of this whole idea of like, well, she's a sex pot fan. I get it that she's, yeah, I get how you can get that. And watching it with 2017 eyes, it's very clear that you can come up with that. Absolutely. Because she is like, she's, you know, she drinks. She's always on the verge of ruining her life. She throws herself like at the saxophone players, absolutely. But there's also a sweetness and a vulnerability and an absolutely. Innocence to her. Absolutely.
No, that's part of the whole thing.
Yeah, that doesn't make you feel sorry for her in a way that's like pity. It makes you feel sorry that you want things to work out for her. There's a difference. Right? I don't pity her condition. I cheer for her. I hope for her. I want her to achieve happiness. And you have her sadness when she sings the song after Tony has, which absolutely. We'll get to later. That's a powerful thing
yeah.
that she's doing as an actress.
Well, I think maybe a way to put it is that it's not so much what it's about her, but maybe what it says about men, you know, is that what is it that we are attracted to?
Right.
And one thing, as I've said, that yeah. she is really attractive
yes, absolutely.
Is that it's not strength and intelligence and, you know, self-determination mm-hmm. and independence and all those things. It is vulnerability and neediness and childlikeness and sexuality and the body and all of those things. And it's like, the, you know, so in some ways we could say, oh, this is what it says about her.
Right.
And then it also maybe is something that it says about us.
Yeah, but look at Jack Lemmon as a woman. Jack Lemmon as a woman is completely
opposite. I would
rather
look at Marilyn Monroe as a woman. Well,
so would we all. But Jack Lemmon as a woman is the complete opposite.
Absolutely.
He's very determined to like stand his ground and slap Joey Brown. And although he's playful with him, he never gives ground.
Well,
he has to chase him. Like Joey Brown chases him.
But which brings us as a perfect segue to where we are in the film.
That's right.
Because intercut with this very sexy scene on the yacht is our date with Daphne and Osgood, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
And this is what's sort of weird about the movie is we go from him slapping this guy's face and being indignant to he's having a ball.
Yeah.
He's having so much fun on the date.
Right.
They literally dance all night.
Yeah.
It's this is where you go, and again, this is 2017 eyes versus 1959 eyes. Yeah. But how are we supposed to take this?
Right.
What is this saying about him?
Well,
my feeling from what I've read about Billy Wilder and heard it, he's not really trying to say anything. He's trying to make a funny movie.
Exactly,
and this
and
is funny.
And it is funny. And but also it fits Jack Lemmon's character throughout the whole movie. Someone with a stronger personality can convince him to do just about anything.
Well, and he's enthusiastic.
And enthusiastic about it when he's convinced to do it, yes.
Just because Jack Lemmon is having fun. He likes to have fun.
Yes.
Tony Curtis isn't having fun. I mean, I'm sure sleeping with Marilyn Monroe was fun.
Sure.
Although, have you heard about what he said?
Did he sleep with her in the movie? Is that inferred?
I feel that they had sex.
That night?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I don't know. Here's my...
I feel they just made out, but maybe.
My general feeling is that if a movie has people making out and you fade to black, they had sex.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know. We have to do some analysis of this.
Yeah, we'd have to look at that.
If we cut away and they're in a room, you know.
Okay.
And then the next thing we see is it's the next morning.
Right.
They spent the night together.
Well, that's... Oh, because they're... okay. Did they wake up together the next morning? I thought they were both like went back to sleep in their own respective places.
They come back at dawn in the boat.
Oh, that's right.
Because it's dawn when the party ends with Osgood and Daphne,
okay.
Where the band members are blindfolded by the end, which is some weird stuff. Strange moment.
Okay.
So I feel that they did.
That's fair. Okay.
So what Tony Curtis said about Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yeah.
So they were in dailies watching, I think, this scene, and Tony's there and Jack is there. Paula Strasberg, who is Marilyn's acting coach, is there. Marilyn is not there. And someone asked Tony, what's it like kissing Marilyn Monroe? And he said, it's like kissing Hitler.
Whoa!
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Tony says that was a joke. Like, what is the most opposite thing he could say of what it's actually like?
I could get that, yeah.
But then also there's reasons to believe why people were not such a fan of Marilyn Monroe during the making of this movie.
Oh.
Also, it's Tony says, as do a lot of people, that he actually did have sex with Marilyn Monroe at this time.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people who say this. Hmm. Elliot Kazan, who did have a relationship with her in the early 50s, said that he had sex with her the night before she married DiMaggio.
Wow.
In his book. Now, I don't know if that's true. Elie Kazan was a player. I mean, he was like a serious... He was like a serial affair haver.
Wow.
You know, he you know, however we want to take that. And whether or not his stories are true or not, I don't know.
Hmm.
But that's what he says.
The dirty business.
It is. All right, so we get back. Jesus. And Tony gets back from his night with Marilyn.
Yeah.
Jack gets back from his night with Osgood.
Enthusiastically?
He is thrilled.
Yes.
I'm engaged. Congratulations. Who's the lucky girl? I am. What? Osgood proposed to me. We're planning a June wedding. What are you talking about? You can't marry Osgood. You think he's too old for me? Jerry, you can't be serious. Why not? He keeps marrying girls all the time. But you're not a girl, you're a guy. And why would a guy want to marry a guy? Security. Jerry, you better lie down. You're not well. Will you stop treating me like a child? I'm not stupid. I know there's a problem.
I'll say there is.
His mother. We need her approval. But I'm not worried because I don't smoke.
Jerry, there's another problem.
Like what?
Like what are you going to do on your honeymoon?
We've been discussing that.
He wants to go to the Riviera, but I kind of lean towards Niagara Falls.
Yeah, the reason, by the way, for the maracas, and this is what Billy Wilder wanted him to do, one thing that happens when you see a comedy in a movie theater is a funny line happens and then everybody laughs.
Right.
And if the timing is wrong in the movie, then everyone laughs over the next funny line.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So he gave him the maracas as holds for laughter.
Oh, that's smart.
And it was hard for Jack Lemmon to figure out to get the timing right, right. on how to do it. It took a lot of practice.
I'm sure.
And Jack Lemmon is like ready to get married.
Jerry, listen to me. Listen to me. There are laws, conventions. It's just not being done.
Shh, Joe. This may be my last chance to marry a millionaire.
And the interaction with him and Tony Curtis is so great. Because like, then he reverses what he'd been telling him throughout the first half of the movie. He goes, just remember, you're a boy.
Jerry, huh? Jerry, will you take my advice? Forget about the whole thing, will you? Just keep telling yourself you're a boy. You're a boy.
I'm a boy.
That's the boy.
Oh, I'm a boy. I'm a boy. I wish I were dead. I'm a boy. Oh, boy, am I a boy.
And again, you go like, how am I supposed to take this about Jack Lemmon? And the answer, I think, is it's just funny.
It's just funny, yeah. Because Jack Lemmon is so caught up in the idea of being engaged. And he has his own plan because he's like, well, then he'll get it annulled. Then he'll give me a nice little settlement. I'll live off the alimony. Like, he has his whole plan set out himself. So that's part of what his excitement is as well.
Absolutely.
I think. Yeah.
Well, because his whole life he's been missing security.
Yeah.
I want security, you know? And this is a way to get it.
Interesting. Yes, go ahead.
So then we get who shows up. But Sugar, the line is, it's me, Sugar.
Yeah.
We have to talk about this for a moment.
Okay.
Because this is the trouble with Marilyn. That scene took 80 takes. One line, it's me, Sugar.
Wow.
80 takes. Marilyn is not easy on your movie.
No.
Particularly at this time in her life. Mm-hmm. She would show up 3 or 4 hours late saying, oh, I got lost on the way to the studio. She rarely knew her lines. She was So she had gone to the actor's studio in the mid-50s, studying with Lee Strasberg.
Yeah.
Paul Strasberg's Lee Strasberg's wife. She is on the set. After every take, she doesn't look to Billy Wilder, the director. She looks to Paul Strasberg, which is... does happen on, you know, on movie sets. Mm-hmm. I, as a director, have issues with it, you know.
You've had that happen with you?
I have, yeah.
You've had acting coaches on set?
Not on set. I had an actor once who was on the phone between takes calling his acting coach.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah, on a short I did.
I would fire that actor in a heartbeat.
Well.
I'm the director, shithead.
Well, but this
get off my movie.
Well, Billy Wilder didn't fire, you know, couldn't get rid of Paula Strasberg.
No, because Strasberg is a strong name. That's a real tough thing.
Well, and it's Marilyn.
Yeah, it's Marilyn. It's Marilyn. Right.
And what he told, what Wilder told Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, he said, you guys have to be perfect every time.
Oh, shit.
Because when Marilyn is good, that's the take we're using.
Oh, my God.
And they did. And
what
so,
pressure.
Yeah. And so, and this is literally 80 takes to do this one line.
Wow.
And she's in tears and she's insecure and she runs off to her dressing room and he's trying to talk her down. And
the original diva. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and she's dealing with, we have to say that 1959 is not a good year for her.
Right.
Her marriage with Arthur Miller is breaking up. Mm-hmm. She's lost 2 babies. She's been pregnant twice and lost two babies.
Wow.
She'd been pregnant really right before they started shooting this.
Wow.
This is when her alcohol and drug addiction is really kind of
starting,
and all of those insecurities and fragility and emotional stuff, along with maybe some diva stuff too, is hitting the head.
And I'm sure she's been seeing Kennedy on the side too, because at this point, you know, Kennedy becomes president the next year, and she does that happy birthday thing. So. She wasn't like she just started seeing Kennedy like January of 1960.
I don't know when she started seeing him as a candidate. Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea when she started seeing
him. I'll put money on it.
Okay. But she's going through a lot.
Yeah.
And this movie is going way over budget.
Yeah.
Because they just, because of Marilyn. It's not like it's a complicated movie.
Right.
Simple movie. They wrote, it's me, Sugar, on the door. And she couldn't get it right. And later on scene where she's looking for her bourbon, they wrote the lines in all the drawers of the piece of furniture. So whatever drawer she opened up, her lines would be there. She went to the wrong piece of furniture. You know?
Jeez.
And I'll tell you, here's what Billy Wilder said shortly after making this movie about Marilyn. He said, she has breasts like granite, she defies gravity, and has a brain like Swiss cheese, full of holes. I've discussed this with my doctor and my psychiatrist, and they tell me I'm too old, too rich to go through this again. That's what he said at the time. Here's what he said a little later. I had no problem with Marilyn Monroe. Monroe had problems with Monroe. When it was all done and my stomach got back to normal, it seemed well worth the agony of working with her. And this is, seems to be what they all said.
Yeah.
Is that it was brutal. You know, in a way, it's a strange analogy. It's horrible. I'm going to say it anyway, which is you could compare it to Jaws and the shark doesn't work. You know, is that in the end, the movie is great. Yeah. And that's all anybody cares about.
Yep.
But during the process, it was horrible.
And I'm sure there are a number of male actors who are just as difficult to deal with at this time through decades in Hollywood as well.
Of course.
Issues coming in late, demanding certain things. I mean, this whole idea of the diva being just only female is, to me, is something I really rail against or push back against. Because I've heard so many stories about male, Brando being one of them.
Absolutely.
Brando was a monster asshole.
Well, we talked about in Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not even when he was younger, he was a monster asshole. I read his biography, a couple of his biographies, monster asshole. So it was like there's a lumber of, they take liberties, you know.
Well, in general, fame is not healthy.
No, no. And especially if you're unstable and you've experienced so many things and you don't have that normal stability of an upbringing that is calm, it can be very, very difficult. You know, as you said, she was foster homes, married early, sexually abused. These all factor in losing children, pregnancies rather. These are all factored in the situations, you know.
Well, and we don't get to know, the path to making a great movie is never simple.
No.
You know,
there's,
you're going to go over all sorts of obstacles. And this is one of them.
Yeah.
Could you go that, man, it would have been a lot easier to make this movie without Marilyn? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Would it have been good?
It might not have been as good.
I mean, originally, here was the cast they had originally gone for.
Ooh.
Was Tony Curtis.
Yes.
Frank Sinatra.
Ooh.
And Mitzi Gaynor.
Mitzi's great. I love Mitzi.
Sure.
I saw The Joker is Wild. I think it's one of her best performances with Frank. She ain't Marilyn.
She ain't Marilyn.
And Mitzi's still kicking. Mitzi's still performing.
Yeah.
She's amazing. I follow her on Facebook.
Oh, really?
I love her to death. Yes, I love her to death. I had such a crush on her, like watching her films. I have such an attraction for her.
Yeah.
But she ain't Marilyn.
No. Well, and honestly, Frank ain't Jack Lemmon.
Man, Frank ain't Jack Lemmon, right?
Look, I love Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, Frank ain't known for his comedy, necessarily. Yeah.
Well, in a way, I would say you'd have to switch the roles. Is you make Frank play the Josephine role.
Yeah.
But really, Frank, what happened was they were gonna cast Frank Sinatra. Billy Wilder had a lunch meeting set up with Frank. Frank no-showed. Billy Wilder said, fuck this. And he had actually wanted Jack Lemmon from the beginning.
There we go.
So he said, let's go get Jack Lemmon.
Gotta give him the reason.
So everything seems to be kind of going well.
Yes.
And who shows up but our old friend Spat Scalumbo?
Out of nowhere. Who we'd totally forgotten about.
Absolutely.
Right? Billy Wilder does such a great job of creating this world down in Florida. This rich, funny, interesting world. These two relationships. He lets the film breathe for a little bit just long enough for us to have these two established relationships for both Josephine and Daphne, and then Spats Columbo shows up.
With a great entrance, and apparently we're having some kind of mob convention.
Well, it's an Italian appreciators of Italian opera or something like that.
Yeah. and Pat O'Brien's here.
Yes, of course.
And and we walk in, there's this guy flipping a coin, and that is Edward G. Robinson Jr.
And the flipping of the coin is a reference to George Raft, because that's what George Raft used to do. And if any of you are old enough, watch the old Looney Tunes cartoons. Whenever they go and have a Hollywood episode with Bugs or anything, there's always a guy flipping a coin with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. That is George Raft. And I love how George Raft comes back out from that meeting with Little Bonaparte, which is, of course, a reference to Little Caesar, which is the Edward G. Robinson film. He says, where'd you get that gimmick from?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Where'd you get that stupid gimmick from? Which is, of course, a meta moment within
that's what I'm saying.
Which is what you referenced earlier, Steve. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's so great.
And so this looks like it's going to be pretty scary. And again, even with the supporting characters, we have nice little bits like the frisking, got the gun in one pants leg and the bullets in the other.
Yeah.
Like it's all just really tight and funny.
Yeah.
They see that Spats is here, our guys, rush into the elevator. We end up in the elevator with Spats. Don't I know you from somewhere?
The two guys, You ever been to Chicago? We've been cut dead in Chicago, which is a great little right double meeting.
Great line.
Yeah.
So we're back in the room. Time to get the hell out of here. So it's time to say goodbye to Sugar.
Oh, man.
Makes a phone call. It's rough.
It is rough, especially because Jack is saying to him, you never cared before. You used to drop him, which means this guy is not a great guy. Tony Curtis' character is not a good guy to women. He has done this over and over again, but there's something different with Sugar.
Well, and it's that moment where she describes her dream.
Yeah.
And you see Tony Curtis's face kind of fall.
Yep.
And you go, oh, he loves her.
Yep.
To tell the truth, I never closed an eye.
I never slept better. I had the most wonderful dream. I was still on the yacht and the anchor broke loose.
We drifted for days and days. You were the captain and I was the crew. I kept a lookout for icebergs. I sorted your shells and mixed your cocktails. And I wiped the steam off your glasses. And when I woke up, I wanted to swim right back to you.
And then what he does to her by sending her the bracelet, in addition to stealing, no problem stealing the bracelet. I mean, let's be clear. Jack Lemmon worked hard for that bracelet.
Yeah.
He earned it. And he earned it under false pretenses. So the only people who should get that bracelet are Jack Lemmon or should go back to Osgood. But he just takes it, sends it over Sugar. And this is really treating her like a whore. You know, I mean, that's he's just paying her off.
Well, I don't know, Steve. I think that's a bit harsh. I think he's trying.
You know what? I think it's a bit harsh. Yeah. As I was saying it, I kind of feel it's a little harsher than it is.
I think he's just trying to, in his way, you know, say goodbye to her and give her something sweet. Whereas with the other ones, which Jack refers to in the movie, or Jack Lemmon's character refers to, he's just never even called. He's just ghosted him, essentially ghosted him for the 50s.
Right.
But in this, he wants to send her something. He wants to give her something to remember him by.
You're right.
Bracelet and the flowers is that. Is it the right way to do it? Marilyn comes in super depressed.
Sure.
It's almost irrelevant, whatever he gave her, because it's his heart that she wants, not any of his gifts. And that's a great thing, too. We see the switch from the woman who wanted security and a rich guy with a yacht. She actually is falling for him, too, irregardless of his money.
Yeah.
It doesn't like she gets all that and she goes, oh, I can trade this in and be something with this money, blah, blah, blah. No, she's like depressed.
Well, and the same thing that happens with her really happens with Tony, because the moment before, Tony's like, this bracelet is our future.
Yeah.
So he trades security for something compassionate.
Right.
Well, they got to get out of the hotel because Spatz is here.
Right. Yeah.
And this is what you mentioned before. Yeah. Let's climb out the window.
Once again, let's climb down the what passes for a fire escape at a Florida resort.
Yeah. Right?
Climbing down the other side. Yeah.
Which, by the way, is the Hotel Del Coronado in San Diego.
Oh.
A beautiful hotel right.
That is a beautiful hotel. Yeah.
It's gorgeous. I've been there. It's a very famous hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and unfortunately, when they climb down in front of the window, whose window do they climb right in front of?
But Spatz. Yeah. And then Spatz is the one that recognizes them.
Yep.
Hey, they might not be dames at all, blah, blah, blah.
Well, and they find the instruments and that confirms it.
Yeah. Which is interesting because how would they have known that they shot the base? But once they see the bullet holes, they
if
get
you see
the
bullet
idea.
Holes in the base and you suspect these people anyway,
that's good.
It's a pretty good deal.
Yeah. That's why he's the leader.
Now we get into this really fun chase where there's like a guy in a wheelchair and we're supposed to be the guy in the wheelchair. We're running around through the kitchens. And it's a really fun, well-constructed chase while simultaneously there's a big mobster party and we have a giant cake.
We do.
Yeah. And who's going to get in the giant cake but Edward G. Robinson Jr. with a machine gun.
Right.
Like, oh, there's something bad's about to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And we'd seen this before with cakes and...
I mean, the last movie we had someone jump out of a cake, it was Debbie Reynolds jumping out of a cake and singing in the rain.
Right.
I much prefer that. That would be my taste.
Yeah, but then we get Bonaparte talking and we know that he's... Just, we hear that Matchstick Charlie, whatever his name is...
Toothpick Charlie.
Toothpick Charlie was... Matchstick Toothpick Charlie was... He went to school with little Bonaparte.
Yeah.
Like they were in... And they grew up for years together. So he takes the death, the seven people that died, he takes it a little harder.
Really, seriously.
Because Toothpick Charlie is one of those guys, is one of his friends, right?
And so as he's making this speech, who's hiding under the table right at Spatz's feet is Jack and Tony.
Right.
And it's great, too, because, you know, I don't know if he intentionally set up the shoes in order that we could see them under the table.
Oh, I think so.
I mean, that's just great storytelling.
It's from the beginning. You see the bits that are going to be played out just by the shoes.
Right, but my question is when did they come up with the idea for recognizing the shoes under the table? Did they come up with the cool shoes because they knew they were going to recognize them under the table?
Oh.
Or did they come up with the cool shoes as a character choice at the beginning of the movie and then realize they could use it under the table later on?
I have a feeling that they came up with it as a character choice at the beginning of the movie because they use it like when the guy drips the coffee on him at the beginning. His name is Spatz. Whenever he's shown first, he's shown the feet coming first to the Spatz. So to me, I think it was all played. It was all mapped out from the beginning. So the bit so that there, you could use it for bits or moments in the film.
And this is again why this is such a well-constructed movie.
Agreed.
You introduce, you know, it's like the emergency brake
or
blood type O or all these things that pop up again and again is they've introduced them, they use them, they change them, and they become important later on.
Yep.
Yeah, it's really well constructed.
Yeah.
In comes the cake. bye-bye Spats.
Yeah.
No more Spats.
By the way, I love this Bonaparte guy. I love the way he speaks. And do you know that actor is who plays Papa Mouskowitz in the American Tail movies?
Oh, really?
He voices Papa Mouskowitz. Oh. Yeah. He had a very, very long career. And he looks old when he's doing this part. So it's interesting to see that he still lasted up until the late 90s doing stuff. And so I just love his voice, which is why I want to take a moment to say, like, one of our friends. And the thing with the old earpiece, just brilliant. All of it just brilliant.
No, it's great. Anyway. In comes Pat O'Brien.
Yeah.
Our guys escape again.
Yes.
But again, people spot them.
Yeah.
Back into being girls again. We call Osgood. We have to get Marilyn.
Right.
You know, Marilyn's singing her sad song at the end.
Heartbreaking, man.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking.
And apparently they don't worry about the fact that they've lost their saxophone and bull fiddle player.
Oh, yeah, right.
Not really stressed about that.
You got to live, man. That matters more.
Yeah. In walks Josephine.
Yeah.
Plants a big wet one on Marilyn.
Dude, what a great acting by Tony. Once again, like, what's really important when you watch good actors, it's when they're not talking, right? In the scenes when they're not talking and they're watching something and they're having to react to it. You can see it on their face when you believe what they're doing. And they do it so well, the good ones, you know? Right. And to me, that's what I always watch in actors when they're not talking.
Yeah, totally.
What are they doing? And so when he comes down, when he kisses her, and Marilyn's reaction is great. And Sweet Sue's reaction is great as right. well. Ah, lesbians! You know, just all of it, just brilliant, you know, all around.
Jack runs off to meet Osgood at the boat.
Yes. They had called ahead. Right.
And, I'm going to bring my friend Josephine. She'll be our bridesmaid.
That's so great.
Then Marilyn shows up.
Right.
Another bridesmaid.
Riding her bike.
It's a great moment.
Yeah.
Hop in the boat. Off we sail. And now we have one of the great little final moments.
Don't rush to the moment. Don't rush. There's a great little exchange between Tony and Marilyn as well.
Oh, no, I was going to say that too.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say, because like.
Sorry, two final moments.
Two final moments. Yeah. There we go. Yeah, Tony and Marilyn have their moment, which I think is great.
Which in this film, there are no consequences for the lies they told each other. Nope. They're like, it's all good.
Yeah.
It's great.
We both lied to each other. Swipe the slate clean. Let's start over. Yeah.
We're going to be, he's a saxophone player.
Yeah.
Everything nothing could go wrong in that relationship. And then we have this.
Who gambles?
Yeah. This conversation between Osgood and Daphne/Jerry.
So good.
It is just brilliant, brilliant dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And leading to one of the great last lines of any movie of all time.
Yeah.
Osgood, I'm gonna level with you. We can't get married at all.
Why not?
Well, in the first place, I'm not a natural blonde.
Doesn't matter.
I smoke. I smoke all the time.
I don't care.
Well, I have a terrible past. For 3 years now, I've been living with a saxophone player.
I forgive you.
I can never have children.
We can adopt some.
But you don't understand, Osgood. I'm a man.
Well, nobody's perfect.
When I watched it this time, I laughed out loud again.
Yeah.
And that's great comedy. Yep. Even a joke you've seen repeated, you've seen clips of it, you've watched it numerous times, it still works. And it's the two things. It's the ripping off of, or three things. The ripping off of the wig and saying, I'm a man. And Joey Brown looking over and just smiling, beaming from ear to ear, going, well, nobody's perfect. And then Jack Lemmon's pan to the off center from the camera of like, oh, well, shit, I can't. Okay.
Well, what's so here's, I'll tell you a little interesting thing about the story that I found out about this last line.
Yeah.
It was a last minute, right? They wrote it the night before.
No surprise.
And because they're desperate, like, what's the end
of it?
What do we have it? What do we do? And these are the, you know, great joke writers.
Yeah.
This line came from I.L. Diamond. The other writer, Billy Wilder, didn't like it.
Oh, really?
I.L. Diamond's wife didn't like it.
Oh.
And Diamond fought for it. And here was the reasoning. is that like the wife who I saw interviewed, she said it's like a nothing line. And Diamond said, that's the point. Because structurally what's happened, and I think this is so brilliant. This shows like a deep Zen master understanding of, this is like Jedi writing stuff.
Yeah.
Is that there is a build going on. He goes, oh, I'm not a natural blonde. I can't have children.
Yes, yes.
I smoke. Each one's going, I can't have children is the last one.
Right.
Each one's getting bigger than the other. And then we all know as the audience what the last thing in the build is going to be. We know he's going to reveal himself.
Right.
And so what our expectation is we build, huge reveal that we need to get a huge reaction. And the fact that it's a nothing line, that he has no huge reaction, is what makes it funny.
Exactly.
And what's interesting too, again, this is sort of 2017 looking at it,
yeah,
is
what does that mean? What is nobody? And I, really, always, what does nobody's perfect mean? Who is Osgood Fielding?
Right.
What did he know?
Right.
And then who is Jerry? Like, is he, like, are we saying there's a gay thing here? Are we?
I don't think you can put it in a box. And I think that's what I love about the ending, is that it is an open-ended ending for a comedy, which is so rare.
Right.
It is just that he, Osgood, doesn't care. He really doesn't care because there's something about Jack Lemmon's essence or energy that is so attractive to him, and it's irrelevant to him that he's a man or a woman. Because he's at that stage in his life where he just wants companionship and someone he cares about.
Well, and Jack Lemmon's having a great time with Osgood.
And Jack Lemmon's happy as hell with this guy. And he'll have his security for the rest of his life.
I mean, there's no sense in the movie. I mean, he's very excited about all the girls and about sugar and all that stuff. So there's no sense. And what I, you know, in the end, what I really think it is that it's funny.
Yes, of course.
That's why it's in the movie. Yeah, it's because it's funny.
But you could break it down and you can say it's like the first like gay love affair on film or whatever that was really highlighted. Or you can say that it's more about, well, it's about speaking about companionship, because he like saw all these girls and he struck out with the one he wanted and he didn't go after anyone else because he probably just has a history of being a failing at women. And so here is a security with this guy, and maybe this is who he is. And this reaction when he has after he says nobody's perfect is more like, huh. Oh, yeah, like, well, maybe I should explore this. Because Jerry has shown us throughout the whole movie that he can be influenced to do certain things by a strong personality, especially if money's involved.
Well, yeah. So really,
I love it.
He's the slut.
Well, I don't know if he's a slut, but I just love him to death, and I think it's a great ending.
I do, too. A little bit about the reception of the film. They go to have their first test screening, which is in Pacific Palisades, put it in a theater.
Yeah.
They hand out cards that say a major motion picture release. Nobody laughs.
What?
Silence.
Through the whole movie?
That's what they say.
Crap.
Just death. They go, we got to have another test screening. Here are the two things that change. One is they take out one scene. Apparently there's a scene in the train compartment section where Tony Curtis slips into bed, that Jack Lemmon and Sugar switch compartments, and Tony Curtis slips into bed thinking he's getting into bed with Sugar and actually gets into bed with Jack Lemmon.
Oh.
Which, from what I've heard, I mean, it's a funny setup.
Right.
Sounds like a funny scene. And Wilder made the decision, you know, we've had enough time on the train. Time to get off the train.
Right.
Which I think is a smart decision.
Yeah.
Here's the only other change they made. On the card they handed out, they put a minor motion picture, not a major motion picture, which he thinks clued people in enough that this was a comedy.
Yeah.
And then it was hysterics.
And also cheering for an underdog.
Yeah.
That's the inherent nature of human beings.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. Good point. The movie comes out, and it is controversial. The Catholic League says, we got to ban this.
What?
They won't play it in Kansas. The Catholic League, the whole state of Kansas says, no, we can't
have
this.
Is it because of the end moment, or is it because they dress up as women?
The whole thing. They said this movie promotes homosexuality, lesbianism, and transvestism.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, this is 1959.
That's a good point.
Doesn't stop the movie from being a much bigger hit than anyone suspected.
Yeah.
And gets nominated for a few Oscars. Didn't win any because one of your other favorite films took them all, which is This is the Year of Ben-Hur.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Ben-Hur. So William Wyler wipes out Billy Wilder that year.
When are we doing Ben-Hur, Steve?
I told you. We're doing it Easter next year.
Oh, next year?
Well, we could do it sooner, but it seems, I don't know. You know,
All right, fine.
It's the Jesus thing.
We have to wait for the Jesus to be crucified. Respect. All right.
Respect to the Jesus.
Respect to the Jesus, man.
So, really, the love of this film really builds over time.
Oh, sure. I'm sure. Yeah. And you can see why, man. It's timeless.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're watching in 2017, it still works. It's timeless. Great performances, great script, all of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny because timeless is exactly right, because it seems to be of a certain time, but the jokes aren't stale.
No.
You know what I mean? Right. It all works.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really, really funny.
Yeah.
So, John.
Yes.
What are your final thoughts on Some Like It Hot?
My final thoughts are, if you've listened to this podcast, you haven't listened to them, you haven't watched the movie, go back and watch, or go and watch the movie, because you're going to be pleasantly surprised. And so I know some people don't like to watch black and white movies, and it's probably some of you listening don't like to watch black and white movies. But I'm telling you, you've got to open yourself up to these classic films, because the stuff you admire and love today The comedic geniuses that you admire and love today are influenced by people like Billy Wilder, like Jack Lemmon, like even Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe in a film like this. They're influenced by the scriptwriters as well. They're influenced by the pacing, all this that happens in the movie. And the reason we just mentioned why it's timeless is because it still all works and it still is all funny and it gets to the human. What great comedies do is it gets to the human condition.
Yeah.
This desire to connect, this desire to find security, this desire to find love, this desire to be, you know, to follow your dreams or to make a, you know, try something to break out of your situation. And all of that happens in this comedy. And yes, it's a, you know, you're running away from the mafia coming after you or whatever, the mob coming after you. But there's so many great, funny little human moments that you recognize and connect and see in your friends or see in yourself that I think speaks volumes about this movie. And at the end of the day, I can say a million words, but the only thing that matters is it's incredibly funny and it's a great 2 hours spent watching a movie.
Yeah, I'm sitting here going, I got nothing to add to that. I think you kind of said it all. The movie's funny. Go watch it.
Right. Well, as a director though, there must be something you can say about it.
Oh, sure. I mean, what I've already said is that the tightness of the script is really the thing to look at. The way the jokes are structured, how plants and payoffs work, how it builds, it's all really, really well done.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But mostly, it's funny.
Yeah, mostly.
You know? Yeah. Like, because in that, like, you know, I have my cinephile analytical brain on most of the time, and it's really useful, and I like that part of myself, and sometimes you got to turn it off and laugh.
Yep.
Because this is a funny movie.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's what we think about Some Like It Hot. Of course, we want to hear what you think. Please visit us on Facebook at The Cinephiles. You can go to iTunes and subscribe to us there. Please leave us a review on iTunes. I know we've said it over and over again, but it makes a really big difference.
It really does.
And now you can actually support the show in a new way, which is to join our Patreon page and become a patron of The Cinephiles. We've got a lot of great offers for depending on how you subscribe.
Yeah, including like picking a movie that we can talk about, having us mention you on the podcast, having us talk about whatever you want, like answering questions. We might do extra time with guests where we have fan questions where they stay and talk with us for an extra 20 minutes or 15 minutes answering your questions. Any number of things. We're obviously coming up with stuff. This is an amorphous process, so we're going to come up with stuff that we can give back to you all. And of course, it all depends on how much you donate or commit and how long you plan on donating and committing. Because if we have set up some parameters, but we might be adjusting the parameters as we go along. So just be patient with us.
You know, we're just trying to figure some of this stuff out.
Yeah,
it's kind of a new world. But I had to say, we are so grateful. There are a bunch of people who pledged already. Some people pledged within an hour of us announcing it.
It was amazing.
It means so much to us. Yes. We really honored by your trust in the show. Mm-hmm. It's really exciting for us.
And do you have the website, Steve?
Yes, the website is patreon.com/thecinephiles.
Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me.
No worries.
It's patreon.com/thecinephiles.
Is there a dash in the cinephiles? Or no?
No dash.
Okay.
You can also, as always, watch us on our YouTube channel. You can listen to us on Stitcher. Search for us there. And anytime you want to reach me, I love talking to all of you. You can reach me on Twitter at SR Morris. John, where can they reach you?
Yeah, you guys can always reach me at The Roca Says, TheRocaSays. My Outlaw Nation podcast drops every Thursday morning on the Schmozno Plus podcast channel and every Friday morning at 10 a.m. on Collider Movie Talk over on the Collider YouTube channel.
And I think that's it for this week. We will see you next time on The Cinephiles.